Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm David Feingold, the president of Chatham University and your host for The Future of Higher Education. I'm here today with Shai Reshef, the founder and leader of the University of the People. Shai, it's great to be with you today.
Great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Shai, you started your career as an educational entrepreneur, creating a very successful test prep company as well as one of the first e-learning companies. Could you tell us a little bit about what led you to enter those areas in the early 2000s and how those two startups evolved?
So I was involved in for-profit education in company that delivered test prep, many other products, but the main business was test prep for hundreds of thousands of students, a tens of programs from kindergarten to college level. And among other things, we started the first online university in Europe through partnership with the British University of Liverpool. We pretty much were the first university who had delivered universities degrees, white label, in a way. So we had partnership with the University of Liverpool. We delivered their master in computer science and later on their business administration. And it was online and it was the first in Europe, early 2000. And that's where I realized how powerful online learning can be. We had students from all over the world. They kept their jobs, stayed with their families and still get this great European education. At the same time, I also realized that for most people, it was nothing but wishful thinking. They couldn't afford it. It was simply too expensive. I ended up selling that university. As I said, it was for profit, and the rest of my business came to New York as on a semi-retirement, just to realize that it's not really for me. I'm too hyper. And I looked around and I wanted to continue, but it was clear to me that I don't want to do more of the same. I have enough. It's my turn to give back. But for me, giving back had to be in a way that will have an impact on the world. And that for me is obviously education, because when you think about it, when you educate one person, you can change a life. When you educate many, you can change the world. So I looked around. And I realized that everything that made this European university so expensive was already available for free. Open source technology, open educational resources, and the new phenomena of social networking where people share, teach, and learn from each other for free. So I told myself, well, all I have to do is to put it all together and create a tuition-free university. So I did. I announced it in Germany, early 2009. The next day, the New York Times wrote a page about it. And the following day, I already had hundreds of emails of professors who said, and other academics, this is an amazing idea. We want to help you build it. And they did. And this is the start of University of the People.
Well, that's a wonderful origin story. you make it sound very simple, saying all those elements were out there, but the idea of creating a university that could serve students anywhere for free or close to free, obviously you pay in the University of the People model for the assessments, but as you were putting that model together, did you look at different variations? Were there other types of institutions out there you were thinking of, whether at higher ed, or I think Khan Academy was just starting to grow at this level at K through 12. And so I'm just curious, because it's a very ambitious vision, how you put those elements together.
You know, I think that a few things. First of all, when we started, I didn't know of any tuition-free model that, on a big scale, that is out there. But I thought that it can be done. And as I said, you know, I realized that it can be done. And it was clear to me, being in education for 25 years at a time, that that not only that education can change someone's life, but also that there are so many people around the world who deserve higher education but can't get it. UNESCO stated in 2009, actually, that in 2025, three, four years from now, there will be 100 million people who will seek university seats that won't exist. And I said, wait a second, is there a better reason for the invention of the internet? That's exactly why we needed the internet, to spread the knowledge and bring the education to them. So I thought about this model. To be totally frank, I didn't know if it would work, because I came from for-profit education. I knew all the for-profit universities, the online for-profit universities, and Phoenix, at the University of Phoenix at the time, was the biggest. And I look at their model and I realize that if I have an offer that would be so attractive that will sell itself, and I don't need to spend marketing budget, and as nonprofit, I don't need the margin, actually the cost of delivering the degree is a fraction of what it is. So I knew that I can do it in a much cheaper way. I knew that, you know, technology can be free. You don't need to pay for it. You can save a lot, of course, but not have it by not having buildings and using whatever is out there. I didn't know how many volunteers we are going to have. You know, as I said, I did see that people are willing to help each other and help students for free. And there were sites where professors came every day and helped students for free. So I said, well, it probably would work, but I didn't know how much. And I have to say that after announcing, that was my biggest surprise. The amount of goodwill that is out there shocked me. You know, we have now, well, we are slightly bigger now than the point that we started 12 years ago, but we have now 23,000 volunteers. It's unbelievable. It's people who actually came and said, we want to help. So that was the model. It was quite unique, even though I would say that I knew what I'm doing and or what I was doing, because I ran a university. I know how university can be successful. What do you need for it to run smoothly? And even though it's a nonprofit, from day one, we were a business in terms of, we have budget, we have KPIs, we checked ourselves monthly whether we meet the goals and the budget. So we are very, very careful with what we do and what we don't do. And that's probably one of the secrets of, it's not a secret, but the reasons of our success. Yeah.
That's great. For those listeners who aren't familiar with the University of the People, could you say a little bit about how it operates in terms of students signing up, getting a degree, the role that the volunteers play? And you mentioned you had announced it in Germany, but you decided to go for a U.S. accredited model. So I'm curious if you could say, as you were building this out, why you'd chosen the U.S. versus a European or another system?
Good. Well, I hope I'll remember all the questions. If not, you can remind me. But you're right. I mean, University of the People, for those who don't know, is a nonprofit, tuition-free, accredited American online university that is there to open the gates to those who cannot afford higher education, either because it's too expensive, we all know the situation in the U.S., either because they live in countries where there aren't enough universities, and, you know, Africa will be a great example where there aren't enough seats available, either because of cultural reasons, women in some countries are deprived from higher education, political reasons, undocumented in the U.S., refugees worldwide, and a lot of other reasons. And we use the internet to bring education to them. And we put the students, because our students come to us in order to have a better future, we only offer business administration, computer science, and health science associate and bachelor degree, as well as MBA and master of education. And because the students, a lot of them coming, as I said, from hardship, and we have survivors of the genocide of Rwanda, the earthquake in Haiti, and I mentioned we have thousands of refugees, which needs a lot of support, we put them in small classes of 20 to 30. We mix them, by the way. Every time they take a class, it's 20 to 30 new students from 20 to 30 new countries. We do it in a way to ensure that they get this personalized attention, and we do it using volunteers. However, anyone with high school diploma and proficiency in English can start. We ask them to take two courses to see that they like our pedagogy to start with. You know, you need a self-discipline in order to study online. You need the motivation. Our pedagogy is peer-to-peer learning. Some people don't like it. So they need to go take these two courses, see that they like us. But for us, it's a great screening mechanism. Show us that you meet our academic standards. If you meet them, you get credit for these two courses and you continue with us. You do not, if you can't make it, you can't make it. So you cannot continue with us. You can take the course again, but you cannot continue unless you pass it. Did I forgot part of the question?
No, that's great. The only part there, you mentioned that it was U.S. accredited. And so I'm curious why you had decided on that approach.
So, you know, the point is, it was very clear. We are, the only reason we exist is our students. And we do what our students need. Students around the world want American degree. The American higher education is the standard of quality. And everyone around the world want American accredited degree. So we started as an American university. We are licensed in California. We saw how important it is for our students that we will be accredited, which obviously makes sense. So we received our initial accreditation in 2014. And now that we see that students are asking about additional regional accreditation, we are pursuing another accreditation with WASC. So, you know, we are there, and the same goes with the degrees that we offer. We chose those degrees that help our students find a job or are in big demand in their country. So business administration, computer science are in big demand worldwide. Health science and teachers are what, and education are what most countries, especially developing countries, need. So that's why we offer them. So we are there to serve the students, or whatever they need, that's what we do.
And as we've discovered worldwide through the pandemic, one of the challenges with pivoting to virtual education is not everybody has access to a good internet connection, broadband. And for a lot of the students you're serving, I know many of them in refugee camps, others, I assume that's an even greater hurdle. How did you approach it in terms of the actual delivery model? You've mentioned small classes, peer-to-peer, but Are they a mix of in-person and virtual, or how are you making sure that the students who would benefit are gaining access to the university?
So first of all, our students can study anytime, anywhere, with any internet connection they have. So it's asynchronous, and it's all text-based, which means that they can come to the, you know, a couple of months ago, I got an email from one of our students who is a refugee in Turkey, and he said, you know, I'm walking on the streets looking for Wi-Fi, and I found Wi-Fi, so I'm texting you. The idea is that we have students who go to internet cafe every other day, download the material, work offline, and then go back, upload what they wrote, and download the new material. You can study with a computer, laptop, a tablet, a cell phone, any internet connection. You don't need broadband. So for this very reason, when we started, because this is the type of population, we decided that we only use text. Along the years, when we realized the overwhelming majority of our students do have broadband, we start inserting videos. But the videos in our case are optional. You have broadband, watch this, we send them to watch video. You don't have broadband, here, just text. Now, our courses, I'll describe maybe how the course works. Actually, it will explain it. So, you know, when students sign up, he's being placed, as I mentioned, with 20 students from 20 different countries. And with them, they take a course. A course is 8 weeks long, 9 weeks, including the exam. Every week starts on Thursday, ends on Wednesday. We have now over 65,000 students coming from over 200 countries and territories. So we need not only to mix them, but to make sure that time zone, it works for everyone. So we start on Thursday, ends every week, starts on Thursday, ends on Wednesday, the next Wednesday. So those who like to work on the weekend, or those who don't like to work on the weekend is in the middle, you choose what you want to do. But when you go into the classroom, you find the lecture notes of the week. Sorry, first of all, you find the profile of the 20 students like yourself, and the profile can be anywhere from your name all the way to a video of, I don't know, of your cat that you decided to share with the group. And the week, let's describe a week, and let's say that the first student who goes into the class is Chinese, simply because the morning starts earlier in China. So our first student, the Chinese, Thursday morning, he goes into the class and he finds the lecture notes of the week, the video of the week, if there is a video, reading assignment of the week, a homework assignment, and discussion question. And the discussion question is the core of our studies. So after reading the material and everything, the students, our Chinese friend, goes into the discussion question. He sees the discussion question, and he decides to comment, to put his own original contribution to the class discussion. The second student, let's say that she's Indonesian, she does the same, but at that point, she comes like an hour later, but she already sees what the Chinese wrote. So she decides to comment on what the Chinese wrote. And let's say that the third student is American. A few hours later, he goes into the class, he sees what the Chinese wrote, what the Indonesian wrote, and he decides to comment as well. The Chinese is very likely to go back to the class to see what his fellow students had to say about his point, and a discussion starts developing between them. All week long, there is a discussion among the students developing along the week, under the supervision of the instructor. So every week, every student must have at least one original contribution, at least three times to comment on what other people say. And the instructor is there every day to read everything that is going on in the class and to get involved only if there is need for him or her to get involved, if someone says something wrong and nobody corrects the mistake. If someone asked a question and nobody was willing to, whether it's a mistake and needs to be corrected, whether it is a question that nobody knows the answer, or maybe just the discussion went to the wrong direction and needs to be redirected. So for that, the instructor is there. Toward the end of the week, the students take a quiz to see that they mastered the material. They hand in their homework, which is assessed anonymously and randomly by three of their peers under the supervision of the instructors, who has the right to override the grades that they gave each other. So that every week they get grade for their contribution to the class discussion, for their quiz, for their homework, and for their log, if there was a log that week, and they move to the next week. 8 weeks in a row, by the ninth week, they take a final exam, which is proctored, and they get grades for the course and go to the next week. It's an extremely intense commitment. It's very interactive. It requires students 15 to 20 hours per course. We don't let them take more than two courses at a time. One of the reasons that I mentioned the two courses that they take as they start, you know, we tell them it's 15 to 20 hours, and the human nature is to say, well, that's for others. I can do it in an hour. Well, 1 hour goes by and you are gone because you can't make it in an hour. It's very intense. It's very intensive, but it's very interactive. I think, you know, talking about the pandemic, you're right. I mean, you know, a lot of the fact that we are asynchronous and it's all text-based, students can study from every part of the world. But I think that another difference is that our pedagogy is extremely interactive. And a lot of universities, took them a long time, and some still don't, understand that the success on the internet is interaction. Get the students involved, otherwise they don't succeed. And, you know, shutting down campus doors and going online and have 2 hours Zoom by the professor is not online learning. So we develop our pedagogy and we see it successful. So, yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can you say a little more about the instructors? You mentioned now you have 23,000 volunteers overall. Sounds like this is quite a demanding ask of them in overseeing that week-long chat and then being able to make sure the grading is consistent. And I also know that the accreditors, having gone through that process, ourselves at many U.S. universities, they're very, you know, demanding of assuring the quality control in terms of typically, right, with full-time employees as faculty, still to ensure that you have all of that in place. How are you doing that with this vast volunteer workforce to satisfy them that, you know, your degree is being delivered to the standard that is being expected?
So, first of all, you're right. I mean, it's very demanding. We have 23,000 volunteers. 15,000 of them are academics. But the reality is that about 1,000 of them are actually teaching in the classes. We don't need that many. So we can't offer the opportunities to everyone. But they are volunteers, and we treat them as volunteers, even though It was quite demanding. Typically, instructors spend 10 to 15 hours a week, which is, you know, it's quite demanding. All of them need to have the relevant degree. We give high priority to those who come with online experience, but we train them when they come to us. And I guess that the fact that hardly any one of them leave us means that they like working with us. I think that, you know, we are a mission-driven institution, and the type of students that we have, the diversity that we have, hardly any university has. I mean, looking about, I said that we have 65,000 students, 25% of them are American. But when you look at our American students, 30% of them are Black, compared to 14% nationally. First generation, 60%, compared to 33% nationally. Some say that it's even lower. 50% of our students are parents, compared to 22% average. And by the way, 30% of our faculty are Black, compared to 6% nationally. So, you know, we are a different kind of university. And for a lot of professors, whether they are retired professors who like to teach, whether it's tenure professors elsewhere that want to give back, or whether they are young professors who want PhDs, who want experience, we are a great place. And you are exposed to amazing students with amazing stories, and you know it fills you up. So it's really a great feeling to work with our students. But saying that, first of all, as I said, we ensure the standard. I think that every term I have a few cases where we ask some of our volunteers to stop teaching. They are not meeting our standards, and then I get emails from instructors saying, "We don't understand the rules of the game. I'm a volunteer. How can you fire me?" Right? But that's the case. I mean, if you are not up to our standards, you can't teach us. Now, you know, you were talking about our accreditation. So basically what they check is they check our curriculum. They check how much interaction there is with the students. But the most important thing is the learning outcome, whether the students achieve the learning outcome, and whether we measure them and we can show them that we meet the standards. And by the way, we have articulation agreements. We have collaboration with Harvard Business School and NYU and Berkeley and Edinburgh and LIU and McGill and IFAT, which is a women university in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. And in many of them, the agreements are different. But Berkeley, for example, our students, after 2 years with us, when they receive their associate degree, they can apply. And if they're being accepted they meet Berkeley standards, they accept their associate degree and they can continue to complete the degree the other 2 years to get a bachelor degree. But that's, you know, beyond the amazing opportunity for our student. For us, it basically means that Berkeley accept our degree because they checked what we're teaching and they decided that it meet their standards. So, you know, we have a high standards. By the way, the first students who went to Berkeley through this agreement, she completed her degree in Berkeley with a straight A and was just accepted to a graduate school in MIT. So
that's pretty good validation right there. Yeah.
Right.
Could you say a little about, you've mentioned the huge growth. I think you had 177 when you started in 2009. Now you're at 65,000. And so what is the profile look like of the students and the faculty in terms of age, country, geographic distribution?
So The average age is late 20s or early 30s, even though we have over 6,000 refugees. 10% of our student population are refugees, and they actually are younger because a lot of them are Syrian who were forced to leave the country and stop their education, and they come back to us right away. But a lot of our students are older people who either start college and drop out because they were not serious, or people who went right to work after high school, but a few years later they realized that they got stuck and there is a glass ceiling and they need the education in order to move on, so they come to us. During the pandemic, we have a lot of students who lost their jobs following the recession and the situation, and many of them either need to complete their degrees because they never completed their degrees, or they need to change career. They tend to be older. I mentioned that we have a lot of parents and a lot of first-generation students. The parents obviously tend to be older. By the way, Miko, the first students who made it to Berkeley studied while she gave birth to her child, and you know, for women who are stay-home moms, and especially those who are gave birth recently, it's a great opportunity because you can study anytime, anywhere, as I mentioned. Yeah, so this is the profile of the students. In terms of faculty, again, I mean, almost all of them are from the U.S. We are a U.S. university, and almost all the faculty are from the U.S. Again, it's between young PhDs all the way to retired professors. So it's really mixed, and they're coming from all sorts of universities. We started recently, September, half a year ago, a university in Arabic, where we offer an associate degree in business administration in Arabic, mainly for Syrian refugees. We have refugees who teach for us and refugees who study with us, and simply because we had 2 years, in the last 2 years, 125,000 Syrian refugees who applied to the university and couldn't make it because of the language. So we decided to develop a program in Arabic, and now we offer it in Arabic. The Arabic is actually being taught from the Middle East. So the students are from all over. Many of them, as I mentioned, are Syrian refugees, which are also spread in the entire region, but the people who work there, whether it is the administration or the faculty, are from Egypt, Palestine, Jordan, Turkey, all over the region. Yeah,
great. So obviously, to grow a university this quickly and serve so many students around the world is a huge task. Besides yourself, and the 23,000 volunteers, are there many full-time employees of University of the People, and what are they doing? What are their roles?
So the system that we build, actually almost from the very beginning, is that we have volunteers, but the volunteers are backed up by paid personnel. So if our provost and the vice provost are volunteers, we have an executive vice president for academic operations who actually back them up. And the reason for that is that, first of all, we want to ensure that if they want to step down, someone is there to replace them right away until we find another volunteer. But also, when you have volunteers, you really want to take the essence from them. So our deans are volunteers. But, when you look at deans at a regular university, well, large part of their job, I wouldn't say 80 or 90%, but large part of their job is actually administration. And we take the administration from our volunteers and the paid personnel doing it. So when we talk to, for example, to Dalton Conley, who is our dean, health science dean, he's in Princeton, and we come and need his advice and have issues in the program, academic issues, you know, he's the person to answer, but he doesn't need with the administration. So we save a lot of work from them and ensure that they get we get from them only the things that only them then only they can give us. So first of all, this system work great, but you know that the admission is done by paid personnel. The legal, well, we had a pro bono law firms and pro bono counsel. Now we actually brought it into a paid personnel. We still use a lot of pro bono legal advice. Student services. We have program advising every student from the day he gets in as a program advisors that help them navigate throughout the degree. They're all paid personnel and they spread, you know, all over the world. So that's how we ensure that the system works.
And given that you're not charging the students other than for the exam, how are you funding that core employee base?
So last year we ended up with a budget of $13 million. To give you the comparison, and I guess you know it by yourself, but you know, I compare ourselves to NYU, which we are partnered with, and we have mutual friends there. And NYU has 51,000 students. At the time when we had, last year we had, last term we had 57,000 volunteers. So we were, you know, in a way similar in size. We were slightly bigger. And actually, another similarity is that both of us have a budget of 13, with one difference. They had $13 billion budget. We had $13 million budget. Now, their budget is 1,000 times bigger than us, which is not a fair comparison. We are not a research university. We don't have tenure professors. We don't have building. There are the reasons why we can do it. But we are operating on a very lean budget. We give the students only what they need for their education and nothing but. So we don't have extracurricular. Well, we hardly have extracurricular activities. We don't have a support that other, you know, psychological support and medical support, which simply don't have it. So we operate from every part of the world. We don't have buildings. So we have a lot of things that, and obviously the volunteers, so we save cost. However, we charge the students when they get to the exam, $120 for each end of course exam, which makes it $4,800 for a full BA degree. And by the way, if they don't have the money, we try to offer them as much scholarships as we can. This ends up to be, with the grant that we got, ends up to be $13 million. This is enough for us, for our operation. So, and because we operate, as I said, on a shoestring, and it is enough. So the money, by the way, the money that we get from the students cover all of our operation. Donations for us is either for the development of new programs or for scholarships. But if you just take the operation, we do not need actually donations. We do need them, obviously, for other things which are extremely important, but we are financially sustainable only from that amount. Yeah, different.
That's
model.
Amazing.
Very different model.
And can you say a little in terms of what you see as the future growth? You've gotten to, you know, so quickly to serving now over 60,000 students. What do you see over the next 5 years in terms of where you'd like to be in terms of both numbers, but also will the degree offerings change, do you think? You mentioned adding Arabic. Are you planning to expand in that?
So The best answer I can give is that we will continue growing as long as there is a demand out there and as long as we can maintain the quality. The second we see that we are need to sacrifice the quality, we'll stop growing that second. However, assuming that we can maintain the quality, we will continue growing as long as there is a need out there. Until other will replicate what we do, and all the students in the world will be served, because we're building a model. We're building a model to show that higher education can be affordable, accessible, with the right quality. And all the students in the world deserve to have the opportunity of higher education, and we show that it can be done. So our growth part of partially is to serve these people, but also to show others that this model is, you know, the fact that we are financially sustainable and that we are accredited is a great sign. And I'm sure that it won't take long before others will replicate us, whether it is a other entrepreneurs, whether it is other universities or other countries. And we'll continue until the world doesn't need us. And I found myself once saying it, I'll say it again, we'll continue to grow until one day we'll wake up and realize that all the students in the world are being served. So there is no need for us. And then we'll go to back to sleep and wake up with another dream. But until then, we'll continue growing. I think that along the way, slowly, we'll add more programs. You know, because if you have 1,000 students, you can split them between 2 degrees. When you have 100,000 students, you can split them between more than 2 degrees and still be efficient. Regarding other languages, you know, I'm not sure for two reasons. First of all, even though Arabic was easy for us relatively, because all of our IT is being developed in the West Bank, Palestine. So they are native Arab speaking, so it was easy for them to make the conversion. Going into Chinese, that would be harder, or even Spanish. But I think that if we get the funding, and that's the major thing, if we get the funding, we might go into other languages after doing studies, but... And the same goes to other programs, but we only offer programs that we feel that that are important for our students to have. So, yeah.
When we first spoke, I mentioned to you the idea of the income share agreement, because even at that very low price of $4,800 for the full degree, that's beyond many of the people you're most wanting to serve. I think you had mentioned that you since experimented with this. So I was wondering if you could share what that looks like, and is that something you see may help you to further expand the access for this?
We partially tried it, and I have to admit that we should do much more, learn it more and try it more. But what we have done, we developed a program that is called Paid Forward, where we expect our students, when they graduate, to pay percentage of their income to pay for the next students. Not for us, but to pay forward for the next student. We already have hundreds of students who participate in, graduates and students. Some students say, I can start now, I don't need to graduate, but a lot of graduates. Still, we need to do much more. I think, you know, we believe that what we do, we are changing the world of higher education. And they are, you know, they are part of our community. And I think that whether our students paid for the assessment or got a scholarship, they study tuition free. And as such, I feel that they have the obligation to pay forward for the next student. We're building a community of students. We are young, but... you know, I think that it's going very well, and I hope it will continue. Well, I'm sure it will continue. So, yeah.
That's great. Could you share a little about what your day, your week looks like? You built a very non-traditional institution. How do you end up spending your time?
How do I spend my time? Well, So first of all, I have to admit that that's the only thing I do. And I spend pretty much 16 hours a day working. And it depends where I am. But assuming I am in New York, where I spend most of my time, my day starts either at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, because we have people in India, and we have people in Palestine, and, you know, we have people all over the Middle East and Africa and Europe. So I start there. And then, you know, when the morning starts in the U.S., I move to the U.S., and then we have California, because we are... And we have people in California. So it's spread all over the entire day. I think that, you know, I spend I would say half of my time relating to fundraising, about. The rest is being split between maybe 40%. And the rest is being split between operation and, well, all the rest is operation if you include PR in the operation and meeting academics. And so, yeah, I think that 60% is the day-to-day operation, including talking to the media, speaking in conferences, speaking in friends, colleagues, academics. So... But I think that I spend 100% of my time enjoying it. So that's actually the best answer.
Well, and it's extraordinary what you've achieved. Just to finish, for those listeners who are interested either in potentially studying with you or becoming a volunteer instructor or faculty member, can you just share what the best way to get in contact with you is?
Sure. So go to our website, youopeople.edu, and you can contact me, you can contact admission, anyone you want to contact. You will see all the addresses again, youopeople.edu, and sure, we are there for anyone who wants to study, anyone who wants to volunteer, and anyone who just want to learn more. So sure.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Shai. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, and good luck with the next phases of growth to come.
Well, and thank you for this interview. It was great talking to you, and I had much fun.